And welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with me today, Diane Minio, the Executive Director of CARI, the Center for Advocacy for the Rights and Interests of Elders, which you describe as a local organization with a national reach.
That's correct. We are located in downtown Philadelphia. Much of our work is done over the phone, our direct advocacy. What I always say is that people can call us from anywhere about any problem that they have, and we'll sort it out. We'll help them resolve their problem. One of the things that I like to make sure people understand is that there are certainly wonderful organizations in the city and beyond that help and serve older adults well. But then there are some people who don't know where to go, where to even begin to go. And then there are people who might be getting services or supports in the community, and they're having problems, and they don't know where to go. And so we help people with quality issues. We help people with access issues. So if you don't know where to start, you can call us. And I, you know, one of the things that I think, you know, as a person who's aging myself, I'm well aware of is that we don't really like to think about ourselves as aging or needing help. And so many people, as they age, do end up needing some help. Illness strikes, or even more severely, you know, you end up with cognitive problems and you can't make decisions for yourself. And so those are the things that we don't really plan for. And so many people who are older, who are entering the social service system for the very first time, they don't know where to begin. And many people are in poverty. Or if they're not, they'll spend their money until they are in poverty and they need the help of public programs.
The system does not seem to, I don't even know how to go into that, but it just seems like it's stacked against you as you age.
Well, it is very interesting, because if you go back to the 60s, before we had Medicare, before we had Medicaid, older adults were often, they left their jobs, they retired, they left their jobs. They had Social Security, thank goodness, because that happened much earlier. But they didn't have health insurance when they retired. But they managed. Health costs were not that expensive back then. I mean, it certainly did cause problems for people, but it wasn't nearly what it is today. And if you look at now that we have those programs that take care of a lot of healthcare issues and long-term care issues for people, people are actually spending, I wish I knew the exact statistic, but it's a huge amount more than they were spending. If you adjust it for inflation, they're spending much, much more than they did when they had no insurance. And that's the thing I think people don't understand. They think that if someone has Medicare, they're set. I do think Medicare is a good program. However, we've increasingly privatized Medicare. And now I just read an article a couple days ago, more than half of the people who are on Medicare are now on what's called a Medicare Advantage plan, which are good for some, but not for everyone. Medicare Advantage plans, and I think we have to say this loud and clear, Medicare Advantage plans are private plans. We're privatizing Medicare. So Medicare, federal government pays these companies to provide your Medicare. So you no longer have the traditional Medicare plan. Unfortunately, many people who don't have the resources are forced into those plans because they can't afford to pay the premium of Medicare pays, just to make this clear, Medicare pays for 20% of your care. And so what happens with the other 20%? If you're very low income, you can get coverage through Medicaid for that 20%. If you're somebody who is maybe a lower income but not low enough to get Medicaid, you probably can't afford to pay for the supplemental policy, which can cost, you know, anywhere from, you know, $100 to $300 a month. And that could be just too much for some people. The other thing that I think a lot of us do is we tend to shop for healthcare based on what our health is today rather than what it will be. And so there is a program that was passed, gosh, it's probably almost 20 years ago now, Medicare Part B, D. And Medicare Part D is the prescription drug program. Now, many people who sign up for Medicare say, well, I don't really need that, so I'll just take a free program, because there are some free programs and there's some programs that cost very little. I'll just take one of those programs because I'm not on any medication. Well, guess what? People get diagnosed with cancer. They fall. They have an injury. They're in the hospital. So it can happen to anybody. We hope that, I mean, I think it would be great to pay for the insurance and never need it. That's why we have insurance anyway. But the but it really is important for people to be thinking about what their needs are in the future. And if you can afford it, making sure you have the best coverage you can possibly have. And if you can't afford it, we can help you make sure you have the best coverage you can have. That's something that Carrie does help individuals with every day, is to make sure that they're getting the plan that's right for them. And, you know, you can go to a broker. They'll try to help you. But we don't make any money out of this, by the way. We do all of our services are free.
And you've been at it now. It's 43 years plus.
Five.
45 years plus. You know what? I think I went to the 45th celebration.
You did. You did. That's where I met you, at the 45th anniversary. We are 45 years old, going on 46.
I am new to the Carrie family, so forgive me there.
It's okay.
but so the overall mission is you work one-on-one with people. How in the heck? Let's start with the history of this, and then I want to get into the mission statement itself, because it covers your programming.
Right. Yeah, let me start with the beginning then. We were started in 1977 by a group of people in the community. The impetus was came from a gentleman named Eli Cohen, who was with the Public Interest Law Center of Philadelphia at the time. And he was concerned because, and I mentioned earlier about Medicare and Medicaid passing in the mid-60s. At the same time, we also had something called the Older Americans Act that passed, and that created services for people in the communities. Things like meal programs, you might have heard of senior centers, those kinds of places were funded through Older Americans Act money. Every area in the country has an area agency on aging, for instance, that provides services. And so all of that came from the Older Americans Act. So all of this happened in the 60s. So in the 60s, we had suddenly had a large infusion of public funds going into care for the elderly. And what we didn't have was a lot of oversight for those funds. So before, nursing homes are probably the best example to use, because before then, what we had were nursing homes that were run by government. We had nursing homes that were run by charitable organizations, mainly church or faith-based organizations ran nursing homes, and out of charity. And so that's how we were providing that type of care at that time. When suddenly, and Medicaid is actually, there's a small amount of Medicare money that goes to nursing homes mainly for rehab. Many people have experienced that. You go to rehab for a short time and then you go home. And Medicare pays for that. What pays for the long-term part of that care is Medicaid. And so when Medicaid became available for nursing home care, it helped those charitable organizations that were providing care. It helped the governmental organizations, because now they were able to bill Medicaid. But the other thing it did was it got people who were in, let's face it, we live in a capitalist society. And suddenly people were saying, hey, we can make some money on this. People are getting old. And the first places those for-profit nursing homes started coming up were in Florida, which is not a big surprise, right? and so that started. And today, I just read this yesterday, it's almost 75% of nursing homes in Pennsylvania are now for-profit. And that's a very dramatic difference from even 20 years ago. There are a lot of facilities being sold to for-profit companies. This is all tied in when I talk about our beginnings with the coalition that started us, was really looking to ensure that services were the best that people could get, that there was some oversight, that somebody was making sure that people weren't harmed, And there were people being harmed. Even in the 70s when we started, there were people being harmed. And I have stories I won't even tell you. But it's horrendous. And it, sadly, all the work that we do, all the work that others do, we know that we make a dent in it. We know that we help a lot of people, but there's still a lot to be done. And we've, you know, as I said, this profit-making issue has become really prevalent in the area of healthcare, not just nursing homes, but hospitals as well, where real estate investment companies buy properties and then they lease them back to a provider. And so we're kind of leaking money out of these institutions. So healthcare and long-term care are kind of similarly affected by those issues. And that affects everyone, not just the elders. And so so this kind of brings me to the other part of what we do. We like to think of what we do as a circle of advocacy. So when I was talking about the work that we do in the carry line, which is our call-in line, we also do some other direct programs, like we go out and we're a long-term care ombudsman for some facilities. So we're helping people with complaints in long-term care. And then we have a few other, we help victims of crime as well. And there's a few other programs we have. And you can always look at our website at carry.org to find exactly what we do. But the circle of advocacy helps, though, all of those direct programs we do, the people that we talk to, the caregivers, the older adults that we talk to, they help us to understand what the issues are. And also professionals call us often for help. They help us understand what the issues are, and then we try to target those issues both through policy advocacy and education. And so we do a lot of education for people around what the issues are, how we need to change, what we can do to make things better. We've been, during COVID, we've been spending a lot of time working on trying to make things better for people, particularly in long-term care, where they've been, one statistic that does stick in my head is that 0.5% of the U.S. population lives in nursing homes. 0.5%. 25% of people who died from COVID live in nursing homes. That's very striking to me and something that we should not be willing to tolerate.
Oh, getting completely off my list of how we're going to address this. We're talking about nursing homes. Let's continue. I just saw we have recently passed legislation that says that an X percentage of dollars must be spent on patient care. How is that going to affect things? Won't that just mean that costs are now going to go up to offset the percentage lost to that against the profits?
Well, you're absolutely right in a lot of ways. This is something that has been on our agenda. And as I said, our mantra is never again. We don't want to see people dying the way they died from COVID. And I when I give you that statistic, that does not include all the people who died as a result of COVID, who didn't directly have COVID because we isolated people in facilities. We got calls from family members. My mother lost 20 pounds. She's not eating. She's having cognitive problems. She can't remember anything. And my mother's on anxiety medication for the first time ever because they were locked up. And that should not ever again be tolerated. People died because of that. People died from starvation. They died from neglect because they were not, nobody was watching over them. No one was going out to make sure things were going okay. Family members weren't allowed in. Even regulators weren't allowed in for some time. Ombudsman, that with the program that advocates for people in facilities, was not allowed in for more than a year. So we can't let that happen again. And so this, what you're talking about in terms of that 70% of their funds need to go to bedside care, is something that sounds great. It's something we've advocated for. Everything that ends up being in policy needs enforcement. And that's where the issues start to come in. And one of the other things is this was when we've been advocating for to increase the level of staffing in nursing homes. And right now, Pennsylvania has a ratio of 2.7 hours of care per resident per day. There's a lot of research that's been done that says the minimum amount of staffing you should have is 4.1 hours per day, per resident per day. And what's happened is others, the people in the nursing home industry and the union made a deal with the administration that included that 70% of the funds going to care, but also reduced the amount of staffing. And so it's not going to be 4.1, which is what we had, which was supposed to happen. It's now maybe 3.1 to be there's it gets phased in over time, but 3.1 is the highest, and that might take a couple years to happen. And so one of my problems with that is we're saying you have to spend this much on care, but then we're saying, well, you don't need much that much staffing. So and we all know that staffing is needed. It's desperately needed because, you know, I can speak from experience. My mother had Lewy body dementia, and she was on a dementia unit. My mother was immobile and needed total care. And so when she needed to go to, you know, be toileted, she needed two people. She needed a lift. Two people had to take care of her. There was never more than a nurse and two nurse's aides on the floor. So that meant when they were taking care of my mother, there were 18 other people there who didn't have the nurse aide. Guess who was doing the care then? It was the family members. And so that was one of the things that just kept me up at night during COVID, thinking about all the care that I provided for my mother while the staff wasn't there, and thinking about how these people were managing. And when my mother's unit, like in many of these units, everyone was during the day in one place. So you could see everybody. During COVID, they had everyone in their own rooms. So they're locked in a room, not locked, but, you know, they're pretty much closed into a room, and don't have the socialization, don't have the eyes of the staff on them constantly. It's just frightening. And so a lot of the work that we've done has been around these issues during COVID. I do want to mention that one of the things that we felt was very important, because we started looking at what was happening, who was dying, and which facilities were faring the poorest. And what we found was they were the facilities that had the most people who were low income, who were Black, who were Hispanic. We did a major research study on this, and it's available on our website. And we did come up with a lot of evidence that there are serious problems for people who don't have the resources to pay. Now, I will say that, you know, many people suffered. Everyone suffered in nursing homes during this period, regardless of what your net worth is. But people who were in some particular facilities that didn't provide as good of care really failed more poorly. And many of those were people who were Black and Hispanic.
You have a program. You are a long-term ombudsman program.
Yes.
And we're spending so much time on nursing homes, we haven't even gotten into the rest of your
work. I know,
work.
And there's a lot of work. I mentioned a bit about Medicare and Medicaid, but this is a lot of our work.
I know. But the advocacy work that you do is just so darned important, because who does speak for older Americans?
Right. And we do. And I don't want to leave without talking about, I've been talking about Medicaid and nursing homes. And one of the things about when I talked about Medicaid, nursing homes are an entitlement under Medicaid. There are certain entitlements, like SNAP is an entitlement. There are certain entitlements under Medicaid that every state has to provide, and nursing homes is one of them, with very few exceptions. And so it's sort of the default for people who need that long-term care. Well, for the past 25 years, I'd say, we've been building a system of home and community-based services in Pennsylvania and across the country. And much of that is covered under Medicaid. Now, there are certainly people who private pay for that as well, and we can help them if they need help. We don't really care, by the way, what your income level is. We will help you. I just want to make sure that's clear. But many people who are, and there's been a push to get people out of nursing homes and to not have nursing home be the be the first resort, but the last resort. However, there are some people who still need a nursing home. People like my mother who take that kind of level of care that's very hard for family members to do. But nevertheless, it's been very successful for people to get services at home, not without its problems. We have a system that, again, is changing. We went from a system that was provided by the area agencies on aging that I mentioned earlier that were created through the Older Americans Act to a program that's now managed through managed care plans. And so it's a very different model now, much less personal model. There are also programs called LIFE in Pennsylvania. There are federal programs for all-inclusive care for the elderly, which provides similar services. People can live in their own home, but they can get services in a center. All of their health care, it's sort of like a very pure managed care program, but very small compared to the other program I mentioned.
Let's get into direct services. Let's get into actual programming. And because as a navigator, you've got to be a godsend to a lot of people. But first question, are there solutions? Is there an answer for all of these questions? Is the care, is the support, are the programs available? We're just not accessing them, or are we lacking what we need to allow us to age successfully?
There's some truth in both of your statements. I think that there are programs there. There are services there. It's become more and more challenging to get those services. I mentioned, you know, now you have to go through to get those community-based services. You used to call your area agency on aging, and that was your main entry into the services. And of course, through the public assistance office. And now you need to go through a separate enrollment broker, and then you need to get assessed through a separate agency. Then you need to go to the county assistance office, and it's on and on and on and on. So it's become so complex, and this is why the navigation that we can help people to is so important, because it's so complex that, and you know, I mentioned Medicare, just choosing a Medicare plan. Being able to get the services that you need is just become so complex compared to what it was 45 years ago, when really there were services, not nearly at the level they are today, but there were services and people got by. But today it's just, and now we're doing more and more of unraveling systems, helping people get through, figuring out how to get them into programs, even though the programs are there. And then once they get into the program, are they getting the services that they need? Are they getting the quality of services that they need? Those are the things that, and I, you know, I have to say this, and I don't always like to generalize, but I will say this because it's true, I think, for many people, is many of us don't like to complain. And many older people don't like to complain. And so they sit and they wait and they wait and they wait and they don't complain. Or they have services that aren't very good, but they're afraid of losing those services. So they just keep them. So the aide comes into your house and they watch the television instead of taking care of you. They're doing maybe something for you. So you ignore the watching the television for 2 hours and don't complain. Those are the things we want to make sure don't happen to people, because they deserve to get what the services that they're entitled to. They're being paid for one. And so so it's really, those are the things that we're most concerned about. And we want people to call us if they are having those kinds of problems. I have to tell you that there's so many people who call us. And by the time they call us, they say, thank goodness, you're the first who I've called 5 or 6 different agencies and you're the first talking to me. And so that's what we do. We answer the phone. We talk to people one-on-one. Most of our work is done over the telephone, especially on our carry line. And so we help people one-on-one, and we do 3-way calls with their insurance companies or healthcare providers to make sure that they're getting what they need. And family members call us as well, because they're stuck in this morass as well.
You have unlimited resources. You know the programming that is out there. You actually understand Medicare, Medicaid, assistance. You understand how this all works. You actually listen, you know how to do the follow through if there's a case of abuse or mm-hmm. neglect. And again, you do work in nursing homes. Who is answering that phone?
Who's answering our phone? We have our carry line staff, and then we have our victim advocates who help people with abuse and crime. The people in our ombudsman program answer those calls. We have a program around healthcare fraud and abuse, and we have people in that program answering calls. And I also just want to say that we have a number of staff, and they certainly talk to people. They're the first line. But we also have a lot of volunteers. And I kind of like to just put a plug in that we do like volunteers, and volunteers do many things for us, from being an ombudsman and going out to facilities and meeting residents, to going out and making presentations around healthcare fraud, to helping in our carry line with calls that are coming in, and many other things. We help have people who are volunteers who go into court with our clients. So there's many ways that people can volunteer with us. We have board members who are volunteers and others who work on committees with us and so on. So I want to encourage that our advocacy work can't be done by us alone. We need many people to help with our advocacy.
And how do we access you? And who should be picking up the phone? Is it a caregiver? Should it be the person themselves? Is it somebody who is 55 and looking and hitting early retirement and facing these forms for the first time?
And I'm
perhaps
not going to answer that question the way you want me to. I'm going to say anybody should call who really thinks they need the help. And if it's somebody who's 55, you know, age is just a number. And sometimes someone who's 55 has problems more serious than somebody who's 85. And so we will help you get to where you need to be. We do a lot of referrals, of course, but we don't make referrals blindly. If we send you someplace, we want you to let us know if there's a problem or an issue, or if you didn't get what you were supposed to get, because that's what we're about, is quality. So we don't really want to tell you who should call us. Really, anybody should call if they have any issue, and many times it is a family member who just doesn't know where to turn, because suddenly you have to deal with mom had a stroke and she's in the hospital. Hospital says she has to leave. What should I do? I don't know. And we can help with that.
In a city that is so, and we talked about this before we began taping this morning, that in a city that is so poor, and we are older than the average nationally, mm-hmm. and the state is as well. These kind of services, more and more of us are going to be needing them every day. Right. And how do we access you? What is the carry line?
Yeah, the carry line, you can call us at 800-356-3606. You can also find us online at www.carrie, that's carrie.org.
And that's so easy to do. And again, we touched on so little of your programming today. What's coming for Carrie? What's in the future?
Well, we're looking at, first of all, just doing the best work we can do. We have a strategic plan that we are working on. We want to expand our services, make sure that people, not just in Philadelphia, not just in the region, that people know about us and that they can call us when they need us. Again, we're not for everybody. A lot of people are out there getting good services and don't need our help. We're for those people who are those small group of people who fall through the cracks or just don't know, have the first idea where to go. And so those are the people that we're most helpful to. But please don't hesitate to call us. We'll help anyone.
And that number is 800-356-3606. That's 800-356-3606. And of course, so many people who need these services, of course, are not computer literate or don't have access to the digital world. But it is, unfortunately, the best way to find you is just go to Carrie, and that's carrie.org, carrie.org. And that's for the Center for Advocacy for the Rights and Interests of Elders. And you sure did talk about your advocacy work. Hey, remember Maggie Coon?
Yep. I met Maggie Coon back in the day.
Yeah. Oh, the Gray Panthers.
Yes. And she was, by the way, the Gray Panthers were part of our original coalition.
We never did finish the
back
history.
Back in 1977.
And the history, though, is at carry.org, or call the Carry line, 800-356-3606. My guest today, Diane Mineo, Executive Director of Carry, again, the Center for Advocacy for the Rights and Interests of Elders. Diane, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.